1 John 1:1 through 1:4, the second talk in a series on John's letters, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 29, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Let me just talk a little bit about the background of the 1 John. Traditionally, the author of 1 John is the Apostle John. I see absolutely no reason to challenge that or question that. It makes perfectly good sense in the light of everything that I have looked at and everything I know. So there are people that come along later, because in 2 John and in 3 John, he introduces himself in the letter as, in Greek it's ha presbyteros, which can be translated and sometimes is translated the elder, but it means elder in the sense of the old guy, you know, the old man. So he introduces himself as the old man. But rather anachronistically, I think, people translate that the elder and assume that what it means is this must be some guy named John the Elder. And by John the Elder, they mean John who has the position of elder in the church, in some church, and is well known for his functioning as an elder and has the title John the Elder. I say anachronistically because the more I study the New Testament, the more impressed I am with how New Testament Christianity is not about church. It's not about doing church. Almost all the commentaries you read, almost all the teachings on something like this, look at a letter like 1 John and read it through the lenses of our own experience. And our experience is, or at least most Christians' experience today, is with church. Christianity is mediated to us through this institution, this organization, this community, this established order that just is what Christianity is. I mean, you have whole traditions that claim that Jesus' purpose was to come into the world to establish his church. Well, I just think that's anachronistic. I think that's looking at this experience of these first-generation believers and assuming that they were aimed at what we have, that they were trying to do church and figure out how to do church right. Or some of us say they did church right and we have perverted it, but in any case, it's all about doing church. I don't think it was about doing church at all for the first generation of believers. You look at the book of Acts, and we look at these letters without those lenses on, and my conclusion would be, this is about other things. This is about me. This is about my relationship with God. This is about me as an individual creature standing before my Creator, trying to understand what reality is and what I'm supposed to do with it. That's what it is. Do we do that in a community? Yeah, we do. We help one another. We exhort one another. We teach one another. We encourage one another. We borrow one another's eyes when we need to because we're getting confused and somebody else is seeing clearly. So we need them to tell us what it is that's out there sometimes. So community is important, but community is not the point. The community is not what Jesus came to establish. And therefore, and he certainly didn't come to establish a staid, stuffy, inflexible institution. That's not what he intended to do. So, is it John the Elder? History doesn't know any evidence of John the Elder. We make that up. We just assume that whoever this guy is, it can't be the apostle, it's somebody named John the Elder. I think it's just John as a very old man at this point, as he's writing this letter, who is famous in the Christian community, but he's the oldest one around, and so he can appropriately label himself the old man. John is the old man. Tradition has it that John is probably located in the city of Ephesus at this point, and this correspondence is going out to churches in what the Romans called Asia, the western part of modern-day Turkey, and he was John felt a kind of oversight over those churches and was writing this letter to respond to problems. And again, that makes a lot of sense to me in view of the information we have. Why is he writing this? And maybe I should say first, what sort of letter is this? This is an atypical letter, unlike 2 John and 3 John, where it's very clear that he's addressing some particular recipient of the letter. You don't have anything like that in 1 John. You don't really have a greeting. You don't have an end. You don't have anybody identified, per se, as the recipient of this letter. I think the reason is because this isn't a typical letter. This is actually a sort of theological memo, is what it is. It's this kind of official memo that he's sending out and circulating to these churches, addressing important issues that have arisen. So it's a letter in the sense that it was sent out, but it's not a letter in style and in form. It's more what we would consider a memo form. Why is he writing this memo? As we will see, going through the letter, there's a specific problem, and the problem is that there are these false teachers, or what he calls at some point false prophets, who are among them, and they are teaching a different and distorted version of the teaching of Jesus. There are three, I think, clear and unambiguous claims that these false teachers are making. There may be other claims that they're making, and it may have influenced and impacted what John says in the book. But if so, it's not clear, because, as I will discuss in a moment, there's a reason it's not clear, and that is because doctrine is not really John's preoccupation in this book. So it's not like he spells out really clearly what the false teachers are teaching and then comes along and says, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, and that's wrong. That's not really how he's approaching this. But there are three things that they're making, claims they're making, that I think are clear enough. The first claim they're making is that they know the truth from God. These false teachers are making this claim. They know the truth as it comes from God. And either implicitly or explicitly, they're denying that John and the other apostles are teaching the truth from God. So they're putting themselves in direct and explicit contradiction to the apostolic gospel, the apostolic Christianity. And they're saying, that's not the truth. They don't know the truth. They don't know what they're talking about. Here's the truth. That much is clear. The second thing that I think is clear is that they're claiming that they are teaching the truth that was originally taught by Jesus. So they're evidently willing to accept Jesus as a mediator of this truth from God, and they are passing on to us the straight scoop about what Jesus had to say was God's revelation to mankind. So they're claiming affinity with God, they're claiming affinity with Jesus in their teaching. The third thing that's clear is that they deny that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, this is a shift in my thinking, because First John is the first book I ever tried to tackle as a Bible student. And I've been working on it for over 30 years now, and only now am I beginning to think that I know what's going on in this book. In the past, influenced by commentators, it has appeared that what John is saying that the false teachers are denying is not that Jesus is the Messiah, but rather that Jesus, who is the Messiah, came as a human being. Later in church history, there's a doctrinal position that gets declared a heresy called Docetism. And Docetism was the view that Jesus wasn't really a human being. He was just sort of a holograph of a human being. You know, he was a spectral image of a human being. He appeared as a human being, but he wasn't really a human being. And what motivated that was the influence of Greek philosophical culture on Christianity, because one of the philosophical prejudices of Greek culture was that material physical reality is simply not good. It is inherently corrupted. Physical reality, material reality, can't be divine because it's inherently sinful and evil, really. Well, on that assumption, of course, the incarnation of Jesus is a real problem. I mean, the incarnation of God in Jesus is a real problem. How could God, who is the as good as it gets, as good as you can be, condescend to become evil, to become corrupted by taking on human flesh? And that was a real problem to them. And so the way they solved that was to say, well, he didn't. He only appeared to. He only appeared to be a human being, but he did not actually take on physical, material, human flesh. Again, anachronistically, I think, many commentators assume that something like that is the issue in 1 John. But what I noticed in studying it this time through is, although there's two passages in 1 John where you could read it that way, there are three or four passages where he just flat out talks about them denying the Son, denying that Jesus was the Christ. And those other passages are not clear enough to overturn what seems to be the basic point, and that is the false teachers are just flat out denying that Jesus is the Messiah. So, those three things. We know the truth from God, we know the truth from Jesus, and Jesus was not the Messiah, and presumably with that would come their claim that Jesus didn't claim to be the Messiah as well. It's those teachers being abroad in Asia that has prompted John to write this letter, and he responds knowing how ultimately harmful and destructive that teaching will be. Now, this may not be relevant to some of you, but in the past when I've taught 1 John, I have taken the perspective that the commentators do, that John is responding to what they call a kind of incipient Gnosticism. Gnosticism was a quasi-religious belief that took hold in the ancient world and was one of the primary competitors with Christianity early on. And although clearly there is no sign of full-blown, fully developed Gnosticism here in 1 John, most modern commentators say, well, we see the beginnings of it here in 1 John. I don't think so. Maybe. But I'm going back to the drawing board on that assumption. I want to throw that up in the air and take a look at that again, because I really don't, at this point, I don't see any real clear evidence of that. In fact, at this point, I'm inclined to say John is not going to say anything about and in criticism of these false teachers here in 1 John that Paul couldn't have said against the Pharisees, the Judaizers, the legalistic Jews that he writes against in Romans and Galatians and elsewhere. John is just simply not being specific enough to narrow down who his opponents are. And the same criticisms that John makes of these false teachers, the same warnings against them, Paul could have leveled against the Pharisees, I think. So it's not at all clear to me that we're dealing with anything like a clearly defined doctrinal perversion. And one of the reasons that that's hard to pin down is because if we characterize the content of John's letter, I would say that he's not primarily refuting doctrinal positions. He's primarily trying to expose inauthentic spirituality. That what concerns John is these false teachers can be known to be false teachers, not because what they're saying is wrong, but because they are wrong. Their lives are wrong. The spirit that drives them is wrong. Their motives are wrong. Everything that's inside of them and characterizes their insides is not what characterizes someone who knows God, someone who loves God, someone who has known Jesus, someone who has been taught by Jesus and actually embraced what Jesus has taught, someone who has been led by the Spirit of God. That when you are in an authentic place spiritually, you're not going to be teaching what these guys are teaching. That's John's argument. So he has his readers judge them not based on their doctrine pure and simple, with some exceptions, but not on their doctrine pure and simple, but on their lives. What, look at them, watch them, observe them. Who are they? What makes them tick? What is their spirit? And once you have judged their spirit, you'll come to realize these are not people to be trusted and listened to. These are people to be warned against because they are not for real. They're not authentic. There's something suspect about their spirituality. So given that that's his approach, it's understandable that we don't have a lot of information about what exactly they're teaching, because that's not John's primary concern. It wouldn't matter what they're teaching. They are false teachers anyway, by virtue of the inauthentic spirituality that you see. So I think that's the reason why we have a hard time reconstructing this false teaching of these false teachers, is because that's not John's primary focus. To talk about the letter a little bit more, the language of the letter is very, very simple and straightforward. If you take a first-year class in New Testament Greek, typically the teacher will take you to 1 John for your final exam and various lessons. He will take you to 1 John because the language of 1 John is relatively easy. It's not difficult. It's not complex, particularly the vocabulary. The vocabulary is very, very limited and very small, very simple. While the language of 1 John is very simple, I think the simplicity of the language makes 1 John one of the most difficult books in the New Testament as an exegetical or interpretive challenge. And let me see if I can explain that. That seems like kind of ironic that language could be so simple and yet it could be so hard to understand. But imagine going into a ghetto or some subculture of some kind that has its own jargon, it has its own slang. It seems to me that slang, the nature of slang is, it says a lot of fairly complex and complicated things with a small vocabulary. Well, how do you say a lot of complicated things with a small vocabulary? You just learn the convention of what various combinations of simple words mean, what complicated, sophisticated thing they mean. Now, I wish if I knew Ebonics or something like that, I could give you an illustration, but I don't speak those languages. But, I mean, just think of the way we use prepositions. It's almost as if John is coming along and he's saying something like, if you obey God, you're with him. If you're under what he says, you're on him. But if you're not under what he says, you're not on him. And I'm into that, so is God into that, so you better be under him so you can be on him. Which is fine if you know the convention of what those prepositions are trying to convey. But if you're an outsider to that, under him, on him, in him, into that, what are we talking about? And that's the challenge of reading 1 John, is his language is almost slang-like. These are these idioms of his own, either his own concoction or are current in a certain subculture. But these are idioms and slang that he's using to teach theology. And when you start teaching sophisticated theology with slang, you better know the language or you're going to get really confused. And I haven't known the language, and I have been desperately confused for 30 years by 1 John. It's just this mind-boggling experience. As you go, you just feel like you're being tied into knots by all these string of prepositions that don't make any sense to you. And that's why it's so challenging. One of the things I finally discovered is I as a counsel of despair to myself, I had decided, well, the issue here is that John is not one of us westernized Americans who thinks in linear thought, you know, who goes from point A and develops his argument to point B. Now, he's close enough to the East that he does these mysterious intertwining circular things. So that must be what he's doing. Well, now, the reason I think I have finally got a handle on the letter is because it's beginning to look more linear to me. I can actually outline it. I actually know what he's saying. I actually know where he's headed, what his goal is, and what he's trying to accomplish, and that he's actually going to get there. Hopefully that'll become clear as we go through the letter here. Okay. So let's look at, we'll try to look at the first two paragraphs. Maybe we won't have time for all that. But he starts off in this letter, and you'll notice I start off in italics, because those italicized words are not actually in the Greek text. But I'm going to argue that I think they're implicit in the sentence. I want to relate to you what was from the beginning regarding the account of life, what we have heard, what we have seen with our own eyes, what we watched and our own hands felt. Life was in fact revealed, and we saw and attest to and disclose to you the way to life in the final age that was kept with the Father, but was revealed to us. Okay. The first Greek sentence in the text is not actually a sentence. It starts halfway through the sentence with the object of some verb that doesn't ever occur in the Greek text. But I don't think that's all that confusing. I think it's clear enough what he's saying. He's starting with the object because it's sort of implicitly apparent that what he's going to tell us is what he's going to talk about. And what I'm going to talk about is what was from the beginning, what we saw, what we heard, what we felt with our own hands, and that the concerned life. So I've tried to smooth that out by finishing the sentence. I want to relate to you what was from the beginning, and so on. Well, what is it he wants to relate to them? It ultimately regards, he says, the account of life. Now, what I've translated as account is the Greek word logos. We've talked about that before. We saw it in John 1 2 weeks ago. But the account of life. The crucial thing to understand in this and throughout the whole letter is what he means by life. That's a crucial issue. If you'll notice, I translated it in the fourth line down. He uses it again, but he uses it with an adjective. Life in the final age. Normally, our translations translate that eternal life. And that's fine. I mean, we can translate it eternal life, but I've resisted translating it that way just because I want to try to make transparent exactly how John and the other apostles are thinking about this thing. The adjective that's used is aionios in Greek, which comes from the Greek word aion, from which we get the word eon. Aion is the Greek word for an age. And what's behind that, what they're thinking is, if you look at the entirety of cosmic history, and I don't mean human history, I don't even necessarily mean earthly history, but cosmic history, the history of reality itself, it's as if, they're thinking that it's as if you could divide that up into very distinctive ages. There was another age, and now there's this age, and then there's going to be another age after this, and so on. These are not an everlasting, eternal string of ages. Rather, as the apostles see history, as Christianity sees history, there was the beginning, how things started, the age at which things began, and then there are certain transitions into new ages, but there's going to finally come a final age. That is, this is a straight line, linear, purposeful direction. We're aiming at something. We're aiming at this final last age that will be everlasting. The final age will be everlasting. And that's why we get to use the term eternal life, is because we're emphasizing the everlasting nature of that final age. But that's not what the word means. The word doesn't mean everlasting. The word doesn't mean eternal. The word means of the age, of or pertaining to the age. Which age? The final age, of course. The age of ages. You see all those phrases used in the New Testament. The age of ages, the last age, the final age, the age, just plain the age. I've probably forgotten some, but they have all these different combinations of words that they're using to describe exactly the same thing, that last final age that is to come. Well, what is that last final age that is to come? I think if we put the pieces of information that we get in the New Testament together, it's a time that where we aren't even going to live on this earth with this universe. This earth and this universe is going to be destroyed, and God is going to create a new earth and a new universe. that in a new heavens and a new earth, the apostles say. Notice, it is a heavens and an earth, however, that Jehovah's Witnesses are right about that. It is a new heavens and, well, that's not what they say, but anyway, it is a new heavens and a new earth. It's not in some celestial vault somewhere plucking on our harps. That's not heaven. That's not eternity. That's not our ultimate destination. Our ultimate destination is to have a life not unlike the life we have now, in one respect, in that we remain creatures, finite, created creatures with some sort of body. It's a spiritual body, not an earthly body, but it's some sort of body that identifies us as an individual, and we will have society, and we will have culture, we will have life as we now know it, we will interact as we now know it, only infinitely more glorious. And most importantly, it will be free of death and evil. It's just so much more interesting than the Sunday school image of heaven that I grew up with. That we die and my soul, whatever that is, goes to heaven and floats there. Oh good, I get to float with God. It just, there's no way for my imagination to get around that in any way that makes that at all interesting. But that's not the biblical image. The biblical image is we're going to have this extremely interesting experience one day. And the reason it's going to be interesting is because it's going to be void of death. Death will never rob me of the fulfillment and reward of this existence. There will be no evil that will corrupt that experience, and there won't be the futility that we experience in this life. Ecclesiastes won't pertain to the final age. It only pertains to life under the sun, here and now. Well, all that is the apostles' image of the final age. So when they describe life in the final age, or life of the final age, what they're trying to describe is the experience, the existence that you and I will have when we are participants in members of the kingdom of God in the final age. Well, that's what John wants to write this letter about. Jesus came into the world and taught us about life in the final age and who's going to get it and who's going to be there and who's going to experience it and how you obtain it. Jesus came and revealed to us all the information that is relevant to that. I want to talk to you about that. And then he says, okay, so when he describes it as the logos of life, logos here, I think, is just a very simple and straightforward use of the word, that's a very common use of the word, to describe what I've called an account. That is, let me give you an orderly, rational presentation about everything that we need to know about life. And what is a rational, orderly presentation? A logos of that. So he says, I want to relate to you what was from the beginning regarding the logos of life, the account of life. Now, why from the beginning? If you understand what the false teachers are saying, it becomes all the clearer, I think, why John emphasizes that. These false teachers are claiming to be able to represent to people the original teaching of Jesus. And what they mean by the original teaching of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus as Jesus actually gave it to the eyewitness disciples when he was here on earth, walking with them, eating with them, and talking with them and teaching them. Somehow the teachers are either claiming to have been eyewitness disciples, or more likely, I think, to have received from eyewitness disciples the actual original teaching of Jesus, and that they are presenting that to people and claiming that the apostles have distorted it. The apostles have perverted what it is that Jesus said, so in order to purify what the apostles have distorted, they want to restore our understanding of Jesus' teaching to its original form. That's why John says it the way he says it, I think. I want to relate to you the very thing that was there from the beginning concerning the account of life. And then he goes on to say, I was there. I heard it. I saw it. I touched with my hands what I needed to touch with my hands. Now, how does that relate to teaching? I think what he's saying is Jesus did more than just talk. Jesus did more than just teach. Jesus, in his actions, the signs and miracles that he performed, demonstrated his authority, demonstrated his identity, illustrated for us tangibly, viscerally, who he was, what he was. And I felt with my own hands. I felt the man's arm made whole that had been withered before. I felt it with my own hands. I felt the flesh of the risen Jesus with my own hands. I mean, I got even information through my fingertips, through my ears, through my eyes, through my fingertips, information that's relevant to the issue of who was this guy Jesus. And I came to the conclusions that I came to, and I came to the understanding that I came to, and I knew what I knew because I had been directly, sensually in contact with the relevant data, the relevant information. This was empirically compelling to me. And so my purpose in this letter is to relate to you what I, as a first-person eyewitness who directly sat under the teaching of Jesus, I'm going to tell you what he had to say. I'm going to inform you as to what he had to say about that. So then in the next sentence, he backs up and he says, life was in fact revealed. And by that, I think what he's saying is, there was an event of the light coming into the world. Jesus, the incarnation of God, coming into the world, he did reveal to us what had before then been concealed from us. He did reveal to us the nature and way to life in the final ages. Life was in fact revealed, and we saw and attest to and disclose to you the way to life in the final age. Now, I've translated it, the way to life in the final age. Literally, the way to is not in the text. But what we're going to find is that this letter is all about who gets it and who doesn't. Who's in and who's out of the category of those who will enter into life. So, since that's the preoccupation of the letter, when he says, we disclose to you the life in the final ages, you know, what is he primarily concerned about? I think he's concerned about both the nature of it and the way to it, but the preoccupation of the letter is, who's going to get life in the final age? How do we get there? What's the way to enter into this life? So I've made that explicit in the text. We saw and attest to and disclose to you the way to life in the final age that was kept with the Father, but was revealed to us. What he's saying here is really quite simple. That information, that account, that logos of life that we need so desperately in order to know what life is all about, there was a time where it was inaccessible to us because it was with the Father. And that's just simply his not very clear and rather ambiguous way of saying it was up there in heaven. It wasn't down here available on earth. It was in the divine places. It was in the mind of the Creator God. It was known to him. It was possessed by him. It was contained by him, but it was not available to us. It had been with the Father, as I put it, kept with the Father, but then it was revealed to us. How? Clearly, I think, as the letter goes on, it becomes clear it was Jesus who revealed it to us. And that's the basis of John's authority. I sat and listened to Jesus tell us about life. His information came from the Father, but he came into the world to reveal that to us. Okay, then he goes on. What we have seen and heard, we disclose now to you, so that you too might hold an understanding of reality in common with us. Now, if you look at any other English translations, they're going to translate that, what we have seen and heard, we disclose now to you. I mean, they won't translate that part, but so that you might have fellowship with us. So I've tried to unpack what I think he means by fellowship. It's a famous Greek word, koinonia. Koinonia very simply means something that is held in common by people. This Greek language that we are reading when we read the New Testament is called Koine Greek, the common Greek. That is, as opposed to the individual dialects that you had in the individual city-states, Alexander the Great came along and invented, if you would, a simplified Greek that he spread across the whole Eastern world. And it's called Koine Greek because it's this common Greek, this Greek that everybody learns to speak. Koinonia can be anything that anybody holds in common with other people. It's a word that's used, that Paul uses when he talks about the pool of money that he collected in Asia and Achaia to take to Jerusalem to relieve the famine victims in Jerusalem, the poor in Jerusalem. What's that money called that they have pooled together as a grant to take to the poor in Jerusalem? He calls it a koinonia. It's this thing that they are giving up their individual right to in order to hold it in common with their brothers in Jerusalem. What's mine is yours, poor brother in Jerusalem, is, I think, the idea behind it. And they use the word koinonia to describe that. So the question that we have to address here is, to have fellowship with us is to hold something in common with us. Well, what is it? What is it that we hold in common with the apostles? Well, I think given everything that we have here in the context, what makes the most sense is that understanding of reality. To be specific, the logos of life, the account of life, but beyond that, I think just to have the same perspective, to hold a common perspective and understanding of reality itself, of the important features of reality itself. So what John is saying is, we who were eyewitnesses to and directly received teaching from Jesus, we know where life is to be found. We know what's up. We know who God is and what he's doing in the world because Jesus, who received that from his Father, came and taught us and revealed that to us. So we know the truth. You can either know the truth in common with us or you can be out of luck. You can be on the outs. If my desire is that you hold the truth in common with us, that you have a common understanding of reality with us, because it's true. And I'm going to tell you what it is that I learned from Jesus in order that you might hold in common an understanding of reality with us who know the truth. So what we have seen and heard, we disclose now to you so that you too might hold an understanding of reality in common with us. And indeed, our understanding is held in common with the Father and with his Son, Jesus, the Messiah. So, directly countering the claims of the false teachers, our understanding of reality is God's understanding of reality, what he calls the Father. That is so different from modern Christianity's focal point, and from mine, for most of my career as a Bible teacher. In my, you know, first few decades as a Bible teacher, I was infected by this quasi-Marxist idea that the whole purpose of, the whole significance of Jesus is that Jesus came into the world to teach us how to do life here and now right, and to create a society and a culture that was righteous. And to live my life as an individual so that I could be prosperous and successful and prosperous in the right sense. I mean, I wasn't a health and wealth type gospel preacher, but spiritually and morally prosperous, humanly prosperous. And Jesus came into the world to make this life better. I remember when I first ran into Campus Crusade, the slogan that Campus Crusade taught was, they took the passage out of John, "I have come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly." Well, that's true. That's what Jesus came to teach. But how did they interpret that? Through the same lenses that I read that. Jesus' purpose was to come into the here and now and teach me how my here and now could be abundant, could be brimming with joy and happiness and fulfillment and all the good stuff that this life has to offer. what's conspicuous is how different John's focus is. John's focus is, the question is, am I or am I not going to have life in the final age? I can remember, I've probably told this story before, but it's one of the most shameful things I have ever done in my life, of which there are many, but I look back with horror at what I did. We had all the college students on campus met together in this corner lecture room at the Quad at Stanford, and we'd sing some songs, some choruses and stuff like that, and then we'd break up into seminars for different classes. And as part of the time when we were all together and singing and stuff, we'd have this sharing time where people would get up and they would share, much like we do, share concerns or needs or just anything that was on their minds. Well, in the singing, somebody had just led us in that chorus, do Lord, oh do Lord, oh do remember me, do Lord, oh do Lord, oh do remember me. And I think that's the chorus, and there's a part that goes, I have a home in glory land that outshines the sun. I have a home in glory land that outshines the sun. Help me. Anyway, something about way beyond the blue, right? So I stood up, and rather smugly and self-righteously and in my state of sheer enlightenment itself, just kind of mildly scolded us for singing that song, because we all know that Christianity is not about pie in the sky by and by, but Christianity is about living life here and now. And I don't remember exactly how I phrased it, but being successful, being victorious over sin, living a good life here and now, and so on. Well, you know, much to my horror, I see now that John would stand up in that group and pat me on the head and say, nice try, Jack, nice try. You only have one thing wrong. Christianity is a message of pie in the sky by and by. That's what it is. Now, obviously that's a sort of mocking phrase, pie in the sky by and by, and, you know, maybe there's reasons that we should reject that characterization of it. But it is indeed about not now, but life to come. And I have to catch myself, because how much of my life, how much of my existence here is not comforted? I don't allow myself to be comforted by the fact that I have an eternal existence in the final age that will be free of futility, will be free of death, will be free of evil, and will be an awfully fulfilling and rewarding existence, everlasting existence. And I'm concerned about the fact that somebody slighted me. Now, I'm concerned about the fact that somebody cheated me. I'm concerned about the fact that somebody lied, slandered me. I'm concerned about the fact that I don't have enough money, and I don't have enough time. I'm feeling the constraints of this existence, and I'm just not happy now. I always go there, right? And I think you do too. We always go there. We always concern ourselves with how this life is going right now. Am I happy now? Am I comfortable now? Is life convenient now? Is this what I want, or do I want something else? Am I satisfied and content now? The overwhelming message of the Bible is, well, of course you're not. This existence was not meant to be fulfilling. It is sheer futility. That's what it is. It was made to be futile. It will always be futile. You will never escape the futility of this life. This life is futile, period. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Even if there wasn't evil in the world, life would be futile. Evil just makes it all the worse. The comfort we need to learn, we need to train ourselves, we need to have the wisdom, we need to have the perspective to train ourselves to receive comfort in the fact that in Jesus I have life in the final age. All this futility, all this evil, all this death, me as I am now, am going to be left behind. It's going to be gone one day. These are just, as Paul calls it, light temporary afflictions that we are undergoing, as we await my real existence, my real fulfillment, the real end and goal of my existence. And the fact that that has been secured ought to loom really, really large to us. If it looms really, really large to us, it will indeed mellow us out here in this life. Because I will accept the futility of this life without kicking and screaming and bitching and complaining, but I'll just accept it as, well, that's what we've got right now. But it doesn't rob me of my existence, because my existence is not about now. I'm waiting for my existence to begin. It'll come. And that I'll be content now. It just strikes me that that's John's focus here. Jesus came into the world to give us an account of life in the final age. And if we've got that, then we've got the whole message. We've got what it is that Jesus came to teach us. Okay, not much time, but we have about 5 minutes for your questions or comments.
Jack, would you please comment, or you could wait for a couple of weeks, on comparing what you just said to chapter 3, verse 17, or in your translation, section 23?
23, you said? Am I getting the right one? By this we know love, that the man Jesus gave up his life for us. Now we ought to give up our lives for our brothers. Am I in the right place? Whoever has the means to life in this world and sees his brother in need and closes his heart to him, how does the love of God remain with him? Precious offspring, we are not to love in thought and in speech, rather in deed and in truth. Help me understand what you see as the potential conflict.
Well, like Logan just mentioned, you're comparing here and now satisfaction and so forth with by and by. And one possible outcome of interpreting life that way is that we have no need to satisfy or to concern ourselves with anyone's needs. Not mine, not yours, not anyone's. And I just wanted to hear a comment from you on that.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about this when we get there, but I think it comes down to this. There are things that you can read in Jesus' teaching in the New Testament that seem to talk about building a kind of harmonious relationship among ourselves with one another. And that's true, but the reason I call it a quasi-Marxist perspective is that when we look at that through our socialist lenses, we tend to think Jesus was a socialist. Jesus was a utopian. He came into the world to teach us how to do society right, to teach us how to do human interaction, human relationships in the right way. And that's what this is all about. What I'm going to argue is Jesus was not a socialist, but an existentialist. Jesus came into the world to teach us how to do me right. But one of the things, one of the important things to recognize about what it means for me to be me right, to do me right, is to be a person for others and not for myself. I'm not a human being as a human being was created to be if I am narcissistic and self-centered and selfish and just stuffed inside of myself and concerned with my own desires and needs. The only way to be the human being that God created me to be is to be a giving, sacrificing person for others. Now, in theory, I say that in theory, I'm a total colossal failure at that in my own life. Compared to what I think I need to be and supposed to be, I'm not there. But I think that's what the apostles are teaching us with respect to what it would mean, what it would look like to really be an authentic child of God. But I'm not doing it because that person's life needs to be made fulfilling. And I need to make their life fulfilling. My goal is not to make their life fulfilling. My goal is to make me the right kind of person. It's a subtle distinction, but do you see the distinction I'm making? The reason it becomes an important distinction is if I give them enough to feed today and they starve tomorrow, I have failed at the first task. But if I give them enough to eat today and they starve tomorrow, I have not failed at the latter task. I have been the kind of person God is calling me to be. And we don't judge whether I have succeeded at that by the consequences, whether I have built a utopian society or not. I judge that by whether or not I have acted with integrity and wholeness and goodness and love and so on. And I think that distinction ultimately becomes very important. Back in my Marxist days, I was tortured by the impossibility of the task. You know, when I thought that it was my job as a Christian radical to come into the world and reform the world, reform society in accordance with biblical principles, and then you look how big the world is and how far wrong it is, you just get overwhelmed and you're thrown into a kind of despair. How could this ever be? But we don't need to despair at living the Christian life, because I don't need to reform the world. I just need to live my life as a man or woman of integrity in the light of the truth that Jesus revealed. And regardless of the consequences in the world, I have been what I'm supposed to be. I have done what I'm supposed to do. But as we see here, one of the things I'm supposed to do is to not love with merely words and speech, but indeed and in truth.
Hello.
Hi.
Should I be worried that thank you, Jack. Should I be worried that one of your most shameful moments in your life is dissing the "there's a pie in the sky" by and by? Because I can beat that hands down.
Well, actually, so can I.
Okay. Just making sure. I think the reason why I personally dislike "there's a pie in the sky by and by" philosophy is not necessarily that it tries to bring meaning into the world that God's purposeful futility has stomped on, but that I don't like popular Christian culture's desire to assure everyone of salvation. The pie in the sky by and by has always meant to me, we're all going to heaven, you know, don't worry about your existential, you know, striving, like what you have been committed to do. That's, you know, one day we'll all be perfect, and sure, we're all fallen now, and we have shameful moments, like, you know.
But oh well.
But, yeah, what the hell.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, if that's what it means, then obviously John would not be on board with that at all.
Okay.
He's going to make a very clear distinction between what he calls the children of God and the children of the devil, and he's going to make that distinction very clear. So yes, that if that's what that phrase conjures up, then that is a horrible outlook.
And really quick for everybody, I've been speaking with Daniel Ray, and I believe it'll happen the second, third, and fourth week of this beautiful month. I will be teaching classes on the history of rap music, of black culture in respects to the last 20 years and what has happened and who Eminem is and why he believes that he speaks for every child in America and whether that be true or not. I would like it if you'd all come. Of course, prefacing this all, things will be said, perhaps not by me, perhaps by me, that probably would receive a parental advisory sticker. Due to the nature of the subject of which I'm teaching about, I'll try to keep my mouth clean, but there are other people who will be playing borrowing things off of that I really am not responsible for. All right. So that being said, you know, if you have impressionable children, maybe you shouldn't bring them. If you don't have impressionable children, hell, bring them all. Great.
And hard to follow up on that one. Having just got through with Christmas, and I was reading this to my kids, and I kind of did a little flip here, and kind of ties into what you're saying in Luke 2. I have the NIV. It says, we all say, well, glory to God, peace on earth, and so we buy into that theology. But it really, in the NIV, it says, glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace to men on whom his favor rests, which talks more of future.
Yeah, exactly. And also of election, of a select group of people who are going to enter into the peace that he's talking about. Exactly. Yeah.
What, I'm curious, in this pamphlet you created, what is the Greek reconstruction?
What is it?
Yeah, what are you doing there?
I have punctuated.
It borders on heresy there, Jack.
Well, okay. The original, the very, very original Greek manuscripts don't have any space between words, don't have any punctuation, don't have any small letters and capital letters. They're all capital letters, just a string of capital letters, one after another. So any Greek text you have is an edited version, in that they have decided what the word divisions are and have punctuated it the way they think it needs to be punctuated. This is my edition of the Greek text, based on how, given my understanding of what John is doing, how would I punctuate it, and I have formatted it into paragraphs. that I think reflect the logical structure of what he's saying.
So you haven't changed verses around or words?
No.
It's just punctuation and structure.
And formatting in terms of paragraph divisions and, yeah, no. Yeah, I don't like it saying this. I'm going to change the word here. No, I haven't done anything that radical.
Okay, this is sort of what comes back to what Terry said about this copy. It has nothing to do with anything you've said today except the very beginning about that. I was just struck how humble you were about if you have a dollar, this is cost a dollar, and to print, and if you don't, whatever. But I just couldn't get over the fact as I was sitting here today how, I don't know, when the state wants their money, they always say something like, well, garbage truck drivers make more than elementary school teachers and things like that, or meter readers make more than elementary school teachers. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's the end of the year, and you don't have to respond, Jack, but I'm sure Dick Booster would possibly hold your check till after payday, but, oh, I mean, what better way to honor something as in-depth as this with some consideration? I mean, a dollar for printing, that's not half the time you put into it. I mean, if we were to pick up something like this at Barnes & Noble or Borders, there'd be a price tag on the back of it, and I think it's a group we should really consider honoring Mr. Crabtree for his hours that he's probably spent on this.
Well, thank you, Brian. The more I live, though, the more I realize what Paul says when he says I'm a bond slave of Jesus Christ. I mean, what I have been given is just a gift to me. Whatever abilities I have, whatever insight I have, is a gift to me, and it is incumbent upon me to share it. It is my duty, it's my responsibility, and whatever I need to do to make that possible, I must do. This is not about marketing. You know, this is about us together coming to have fellowship with the apostles, coming to share our understanding of reality in common with them. So, sure, if people, I mean, we'll talk about this when we get to 2 John. If people want to value what the apostles are doing by supporting efforts with their money, that's between them and God, and is an important thing for them, between them and God. But whether we have the money or not, we're going to find a way, because we don't have a choice. This is too important to not share. So thank you.